Welcome to the Prenda Podcast. I'm Kelly Smith, and I'm looking for the best new ideas in education. I'll be talking to all sorts of people about new types of schools, reinventing education, and helping kids love learning. I hope you enjoy the conversation. Welcome back to the Prenda Podcast. Today, I'm talking over Zoom with Karen Lien, who is the Director of EdTech for Y Combinator. If you haven't followed the entrepreneurial or startup world like I have and many nerds like me, Y Combinator is famous for just cultivating really interesting new companies and not always even companies. Sometimes it's nonprofits or other organizations, but YC has a reputation for just cranking out really great organizations and dealing with really smart people. So think of it as the, you know, fill in the blank Ivy League of starting businesses. And that's Y Combinator, based in Mountain View, California, the Bay Area. And Karen is the, you know, director over the EdTech vertical. So she's looking at all the education technology companies that come through. You guys call it Imagine K-12. Is that correct? And I know that was an organization before.
Right. Imagine K-12 was an EdTech focused accelerator that's now we're just Y Combinator, but
okay.
The resources and community we built at Imagine K-12 are part of EdTech at Y Combinator for now.
Awesome. And so Karen is a super interesting person. We've met multiple times through just different conversations. She sees the world like an educator and she sees the world like a software person. So we're going to have a really interesting conversation today. And I'll get to our topic of our conversation in a minute. But Karen, thank you for being here. And why don't you tell a little bit about your story and how you got to bridge those two worlds?
Sure. My pleasure. So I come from a family with a lot of educators. And so education was always, a topic around the dinner table. So it's been a long-term interest, certainly. Wasn't my initial path. I don't know if we've talked about this. I went into a PhD program in astrophysics and was on that path, but I quit after a few years because I wanted to save the people of the world today here on Earth. So leaving that, I wound up for a brief time teaching high school, which was amazing and one of the most fun and challenging things I've ever done.
And where was that, Karen?
That was in my hometown in California,
Northern. Okay. California. Awesome.
My home high school. So
did you really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny. So you had
this emergency situation. They needed someone and I filled in the blanket. So I had this kind of probably a not typical or not totally representative experience of teaching. And I recognize that. But it was great. And from there, I joined an education focused nonprofit called QuestBridge, which helps very high-achieving, low-income high school students get to college, get to top colleges, and get funding from top colleges. And that was a great place working with these very bright students from low-income backgrounds all over the country and reading essentially their college applications, got a view into how differently students are served by our K-12 system in different environments, in different schools. Got a real kind of personal understanding with reading students' personal stories of how real it is when people say we have two education systems here. We have the education system that is delivering the, you know, best in class education to our students. And then we have these other students who are totally being failed. Was something I became aware of in my 5 years in this education nonprofit. And then an opportunity arose to get involved in education technology. I was connected with some great, really smart people who were starting this thing called Imagine K-12. And I didn't have any background in startups or
you were like a legit education and this is not a slight against it, but if you take, I mean, you could basically have said, if we're going to extrapolate from what you just said, I could have worked Teach for America in there somewhere, and you would have been like many young people, talented young people in our country that are devoting their lives to education. So it is interesting that all of a sudden technology came kind of colliding into your life.
I was thinking about leaving this nonprofit to to focus on teaching or working at school.
Right.
And, but it was an interesting opportunity, and I was already living and working in Silicon Valley, and technology is the, you know, the hammer here to fix things. So, I thought I'd give it a try, and just, I guess I'm an optimist. I'm a believer that technology can help. Technology is great at scaling things that work.
Right.
Silicon Valley is really good at scaling things that work. So I had this hope that applying technology to education could do good things at mass scale, especially for these students who aren't being well served currently.
Interesting. So you're thinking about these kids that you know personally, you're helping them with their college essays. I'm sure there's a lot stacked against them. Part of it, as you've alluded to, is the kind of the upbringing, or the way the system sort of works for those schools that they're in and the places where they are. But part of it is just access to, you know, people, network, a way of even thinking about things. I mean, I know a lot of the people in my life didn't know it was possible to apply to. I mean, most of my friends, and we were very middle class, right? But most of my friends didn't even think, like, beyond the state schools, like, what else would I even do for college, right? It wasn't even, like, considered necessarily a path, right? And that happens gradually, but you have to kind of see it to get there. So it's interesting as you're thinking about that, but then you're talking about, okay, software and technology and how can those things jump in as well. These are obviously bigger thoughts than I'm expecting you to answer right now. Well, let's tee up the question. And I do want to get into this because I think it's super interesting. And I think people listening will find this fascinating. The question I wanted to ask you is, what is Silicon Valley doing to improve education? And so we want to look at kind of that, like you mentioned, the scale up sort of culture and mentality, obviously tech enabled, most companies that are emerging from Silicon Valley and, you know, they're based on some version of the internet or software or something like that that's allowing these things to happen. So keep this question in the back of your mind as we talk. You know, what is Silicon Valley kind of currently approaching and how are they looking at it? But maybe let's jump back to you and you know, leaving QuestBridge to do Imagine K-12. And as you start to think about, okay, I know these kids, I know they're capable of these great things. I want to open doors for them and provide access, not just to the ones that I personally know, but at scale, like you said, to lots more kids in this situation. You know, how does that all kind of fit together for you at this point? As you're, and I'm saying at the point where you're jumping from QuestBridge and opening up and moving into Imagine K-12.
At that point, I don't know that it did fit together.
It wasn't a story for you. Okay.
well, no, I mean, my first meeting with the folks who created Imagine K-12, I was saying, like, technology, how's technology going to help with equity problems in education? You know,
well, that's basically what I'm saying. Yeah. It's an interesting question, right?
And so I had to be converted. I was quickly converted and now I'm totally a convert, to believing that, you know, when school budgets are shrinking, when we're trying to do more with less, when we're facing students who, when we're looking at this, achievement gap that's so upsetting and doesn't seem in line with ideals of our country or of educators, those kinds of problems scream technology. Like, technology helps us do things more efficiently, cost-wise. And it doesn't have to mean, I'm not envisioning a world where we replace teachers with robots. I'm talking about, like, how can a school district office, which is basically, you know, in some ways very comparable to a business, how do we help them run that business more effectively?
Right.
And measure the right things. And just get the things done that need to be done throughout the day. Technology can help that. I mean, look at our personal lives. Sure, I might, you know, I'm happy that I took Facebook off my phone but in terms of life efficiency, but I'm also happy that I have access to it. And you know, all of these tech services that allow us to do things more simply and manage our calendars and
right.
And that.
Yeah.
These are good things. By and large.
And there's an efficiency argument, it sounds like, what you're making, but it's not a something that the Luddites would be afraid of, the literal Luddites, right? Of like, oh, this is out to get us. It's an efficiency argument in the sense that let's run things better so that we can allocate our resources towards kids.
So that's one big part. And also, I mean, we now have the internet, all of this information that the world has discovered.
Kind of a lot of content, you could say.
Everything is on the internet. Suddenly, the world has access to this. And we don't just have to talk about U.S. education here, which is global education. What new possibilities does that introduce for us? You know, the information is not locked in a teacher's brain, nor is it locked in the library. It's on a device that could be in your pocket.
Yeah.
And so I would expect education systems to change somewhat, to acknowledge that, to take advantage of that. And so I think Silicon Valley is can play a part in kind of enabling that and envisioning that.
Yeah, it is exciting. I mean, you start to sort of block out what you know of the world as it exists today. And I know this is kind of a YC mantra, right? Like imagine the world that you think should exist and then just back into what needs to be built to get it there. And that's a way that a lot of interesting companies have started out, but it sounds like that's kind of what you're doing. That's the way you're looking at education.
I mean, it makes it exciting to start. I guess it convinced me like this was worth trying.
Got it. Okay. So how has it gone? Talk about a little bit about, and I know there's probably limits to what your current work is, but over the years with Imagine K-12, you've worked with lots of different companies. Can you give some examples of just some of the, founders that you've seen that have come with, okay, this is something specific about the way we're currently educating kids that I think could be made better via technology. I'm assuming that technology plays a role in a lot of these. Or all of them, I don't know, but maybe give some examples of just so people can kind of picture what does that look like.
Sure. So I think of our startups, most of them kind of fall into a few buckets. So I'll give you examples of a couple of those buckets.
Sure.
Some are curriculum focused and are delivering content for students. And this is where we could talk about, technology allowing us to scale good things. And for instance, it allows us to scale great teaching. Khan Academy is not a company that we funded. I mean, they're a nonprofit, but they're obviously trying to make lessons accessible on a much larger scale. Couple companies we invested in that are good examples of this are, one is No Red Ink, which is, which helps students improve their grammar and writing and comprehension. The product, No Red Ink, was developed by a teacher who taught for, I think, almost a decade, was frustrated with the tools he had to help his students develop as writers, was frustrated that he could give them all this feedback and it didn't seem to necessarily impact their work. And so he created this, he kind of hacked together something that was an early prototype of No Red Ink, found that it was really meaningful in his classroom, made a meaningful change in his students' learning, and built a company to scale that up. And now teachers all over the country, all over the world are using this with their students. They're valuing what this can do for their students. And so that's an exciting example.
Can we just pause for a second on that? I'll just say, if you've been listening to this podcast, you know that I'm doing a little pilot school right now in my house, and we're using No Red Ink for our English, which is, it's amazing in the sense that you can't like trick the computer into thinking you know something. It'll ask you these questions, and if you miss one, it makes you answer three questions correctly in a row. So, to your point, I'm picturing this teacher in his classroom, and he's annoyed because what was one of the kids doing today? Into and in space two, right? Like, so just the word into or in space two, it's like a small thing. It's not obvious to even me as an adult, right? Sometimes I'm looking at it going, that sounds right. But as they kind of figure out and they get it wrong, and it gives them some lessons around, okay, this is what this means and this is what this means. And they have to sort of learn that to master that and move on to the next thing. And, you've heard me talking about mastery on this podcast. I know, Karen, you're really familiar with it, but just if you're somebody that's listening, that's an example. No Red Ink, is something we're using. And I don't know about you, Karen, but I have no financial interest in it. I'm just a happy customer, actually a happy free customer right now. So
yeah, and I love to hear, the way you're using it is a little bit different than the way Jeff, when he was creating this, was because if he told his students, oh, you're I'm always giving you, you know, marking up your papers in red because you're doing the commas wrong. Like, what is he supposed to do? If you're teaching 10th or 11th grade, you're not going to spend an hour in class going over commas necessarily for a couple of students. But with no red ink, you could say, like, here, go do these things and you'll learn, you'll know more. And now it's developed and it's used in all kinds of ways because he's had input from lots of teachers about what they could use. And that's fantastic.
Cool. That's a great example.
Another one that I think you're using is Mystery Science. Are
you there? Yes, I love Mystery Science.
It's an incredible science curriculum. Again, started by a teacher who was a guy who just loves science and is really good at explaining it. And he's kind of a Mr. Wizard Bill Nye type of guy. And realized, you know, in his classroom, science was so fun and alive for students. But that wasn't necessarily true, you know, for the next classroom in his building. People, especially in elementary school, teachers come in with their own interests and passions. And if your interest and passion isn't science, but you're tasked with teaching, you know, math, science, history, everything, science will be part of what you teach. But if we could all have Doug, this guy, as our science teacher, we'd all love science. So Mystery Science tries to make that possible so that every teacher could bring a little bit of that enthusiasm into their classroom, spiced up with their own approach to teaching. We scale Doug as a great science teacher, leading students through these inquiry-based lessons. Okay, so this curriculum bucket. I'm sorry, I'm taking a long time on these.
No, this is great.
Then we could talk about back office systems. I was talking about like at the district level, what can we do? Right. We have a company called Swing Education that helps schools get substitute teachers when they need them.
Oh.
It turns out, for most schools, this is just a huge pain and involves, you know, sometimes you can plan ahead for substitutes. Sometimes it involves somebody in the office calling through a list of people at 5 a.m. Are you available? Are you available?
Wow.
And that's just not a great use of anyone's time. And we risk students losing instructional time if it's not set up properly.
Right.
So Swing Education just makes that easy. Kind of like Uber makes it easy to find a ride. Swing easy to find a substitute. Shouldn't we do that? They connect these networks of substitutes with the schools and make it work for everyone. What are my other buckets?
Okay, so you got curriculum, you got back office.
Yeah. What about tools to help teachers do their jobs?
Mm.
So much of teachers. I know a guy who I probably shouldn't name in telling this story, but who built a very successful technology company, then taught elementary school for a few years, then founded and ran a school, and now is founding another technology company. Maybe you can figure out who this is based on this story. But he will tell you the hardest job he has ever had is teaching, elementary school teaching.
Wow.
and I certainly, you know, from my minimal experience, appreciate that and admire and laud all of these teachers. So if we can introduce some technology tools to help them do their jobs in the way they want to, that's
right.
So one example is Class Dojo, which is kind of a classroom culture development app. Started out as being very linked to kind of behavior management, but now it's expanded to much more than that. It helps parents connect with teachers and teachers connect with parents, and helps students kind of develop their social emotional skills. And so that's a great one. Also founded by a teacher who solved a problem he really understood. Another good example of that is a company called Remind that's also helping bridge that gap between parents and teachers.
Let me just ask a follow-up, and this is really helpful. So you've got teachers doing their job better, curriculum, back office. It sounds like all of these founders, maybe not all, but a lot of them, they were in it. I mean, they were kind of coming from that that program. I know one of the lectures that I've heard from a Y Combinator alum was a software developer that wanted to automate or create a marketplace for home cleaners. And she went and actually started cleaning homes, right? This is like a famous story from
Homejoy.
And, you know, can you talk a little bit about just, you know, the power of really understanding the problem. And I think this gets into, like, there's probably educators listening to this right now, or maybe they read the description and it's like, what is Silicon Valley doing, or, you know, technology, software. They're thinking these crazy, you know, California tech people, they think they could just like come in and like make this change. It's interesting that the examples that you're giving here didn't happen that way, right? This happened from people that really get it. They've lived it, they experienced it. And can you talk a little bit about just like how that makes them more, maybe more equipped or better equipped to be able to take on these problems?
Yeah, sure. And I should mention, most of these founders aren't from California. They might have moved here for a little while, but
right.
I think there is that perception that Silicon Valley's coming in and just saying, "Oh, we have all the answers." And I'm sure that perception in part comes from the reality of some things that people have seen. But I think there's this wonderful group of entrepreneurs, tech folks who are working really hard to understand their users. ClassDojo is a great example of that, because yes, the founder had teaching experience, but they kind of narrowed in on the idea of ClassDojo by talking to literally hundreds of teachers. Wow. And asking about their day, like, what's the hardest part of your job? What's the worst part of your day? And thinking about, is there something we could do as a software company that would help?
Right.
These teachers. And I think it's really important to, even if you're coming in as an educator, which a lot of our companies are founded by educators who have a personal experience, it's still so important to get perspectives from educators in diverse environments to make sure you're not just solving your own problem.
Right.
In which case, nobody's ever going to pay you for this. You know, it's not a good business decision, nor is it good for the world.
Right.
At Y Combinator, we say over and over again, you know, you have two jobs to do as a founder. One is to build your product, and the other is talk to your users or potential users. And those are equally important and deserve all of your time.
Yeah.
So the talking to users part is not to be overlooked. So for EdTech founders, that often means, you know, we help them find opportunities to go volunteer in a classroom or sit in the back of the room and fix bugs, or, you know, make things happen for the teacher in real time.
Interesting.
To get a sense of how their product could be used.
Yeah. And maybe some of this reaction that we, and I'm saying we as a tech community, kind of get, maybe we deserve a little bit of it. Cause I think in the early days, and maybe the natural tendency of somebody that's really good at writing software is just sit down and write more software, right? So it's like, hey, I'll just kind of code. And so that part of it, kind of job number one of building the product, we feel perfectly fine about, but then it's like, well, they're using it wrong, or you know what I mean?
Yes, agreed. And I say it over and over again at Y Combinator, because it does have to be hammered home for a lot of founders. Because it is much more comfortable behind where you type something in and you know what's going to happen, versus talking to humans and trying to understand their real problems, not just let you tell you their problems are.
Do you see the DNA kind of changing? I mean, I know that message has definitely gotten out through the kind of the articles and, you know, the different things that people like me will read and follow. That's a message I feel like that's gotten through to me loud and clear.
A few years ago, I think it was 2011 or so, Eric Ries wrote a book called The Lean Startup that's gotten a lot of
attention.
A lot of people have read that. And that's very focused on this model, this iteration cycle of build, measure, learn. And you're building in small increments. You're building minimal next thing that you need to test your idea for viability. You build that, then you put it out there and measure the results. You have to be clear about what you're measuring. And then learn and try again. And so I think that lean startup ethos is permeating increasingly. And that predates Eric Ries. Steve Blank, who's
grandfather of
exactly, the granddaddy of this lean startup idea.
Right.
And it's kind of the scientific method, right? You do something, you make a hypothesis, you test it.
Right.
And then you learn something.
And it's interesting you make that comparison, because I'm thinking about, I still marvel at this, but I had a graduate thesis advisor. He was a, you know, PhD engineer, like nuclear engineer. I was working on nuclear fusion. As talk about, you know, I don't care about humans, right? This was me and my laser for hours and hours and hours. And I'm building this, you know, far infrared laser system to measure toroidal magnetic field in a, you know, a tokamak plasma generator. None of that stuff matters to anyone. But so it's this giant science experiment and everybody's got one piece. I've got my laser. They gave me at MIT, they gave me $1 million when I showed up to go buy the parts and build this laser. And I thought, yeah, that's cool. All right, let's do it. So I start building this thing and, you know, I'm following designs and stuff. I wasn't just making it up, but there were invariably days where just like, I'm stumped, right? Like it's not working. Like I'm getting this weird signal on the other end and I can't figure out like why. And I would go, you know, eat crow, like go talk to Jim Irby. Hey Jim, I don't know what's going on. He's got a million things going on, but he'll be like, okay. And he'll walk real fast into my lab, throw on the goggles, you know, I've got my goggles on. And within, I mean, so it wasn't the fact that he always found the solution or even the fact that he found the problem and solution within a short amount of time, but it was watching the process. It was like he would drop a filter in here and then he would check this over here and then he would tweak this knob here. So he was like systematically running these little loops, these little build, measure, learn, experiment loops. And I've never seen anybody do it so fast. And it wasn't like I think what I was doing was like expending all this emotional energy on each thing that I would try. So I'd be like, I'd have this theory like, oh, it's probably vibrations. So I'd put all this effort into like trying to dampen the floor vibrations. And then I would look at the end result and it didn't change, right? The problem was still there. And I'm like, oh, and then I'm dejected and I'd go home because I spent a whole day on it, come back the next day. And watching Jim, it was like each test took him 30 seconds or a minute. And it's really interesting like that I've gone into software and technology and entrepreneurship because as I found the people that, like you're saying, the people that do this really well are the people that are able to do that quickly and learn fast. And then you avoid some of these embarrassing mistakes that, you know, of the 90s or early 2000s where people spent $50 million of venture capital and built this whole thing and nobody wanted it at all, right?
Yeah, exactly. And it's kind of also this like fail fast mentality, which starts to sound really scary though when we're talking about education.
Fail. Yeah. Well, let's talk about that. Yeah. Cause that is, I mean, there are 7 kids coming to my pilot school. I know their parents, all of them, they know that this is the first time this school has existed, but like I'm changing my model pretty regularly as I sort of fine tune this, you know, like they're putting their kids' education at risk here too. So, you know, hopefully they're not listening and like freaking out, but talk about like risk taking in an educational context, because I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, and I'm increasingly interested in new school models,
right?
And NYC is starting to look at that as well. And that's a much scarier place to apply this
right
fast mentality. So be careful, Kelly.
Isn't comforting, Karen. I was hoping for comfort.
One thing, I'm not speaking about your students here, I'm speaking about our system.
Yeah.
We are currently failing a lot of students.
Yeah.
So experimentation is worthwhile. But at the same time, we don't want to run experiments that ruin any lives. And in some cases, like, you know, if we're talking about software that helps us find substitute teachers or helps students and parents communicate, like, these start out as relatively low stakes or even no red ink. You know, Jeff started out experimenting in his own classroom with no red ink.
Right.
And then it expanded from there, started in small numbers and quickly grew to big numbers, but failing fast would have meant that it didn't expand very far at all.
Yeah.
It had 2 lives and only be related to grammar and in a lot of cases it's not super high stakes, but then the outcome can be great if we reach it. I think, yeah, school models are where it is higher stakes, but we need these experiments to happen.
Do you see a lot happening? I mean, I think it'd be interesting to kind of just look at, that wasn't one of your 3 buckets that you talked about. So obviously this is kind of this experimental 4th category, right? Of just trying a new approach for school.
And I remember my 4th bucket, which really fits in the first bucket, which is computer science focused curriculum. One bucket because we have so many of them.
Yeah.
You know, in tech world, we're very interested in teaching everyone computer science.
And so we started teaching kids to code. That's where Prenda started too. So it's interesting.
Right on. Yeah. But yeah, so school models as another bucket.
Okay.
We haven't invested in them. I'm not advising anyone that in that scenario, but
got it.
Really interested in following what different people are doing. So I'm interested in following Prenda. Here in California, we have, it started here, a network of charter schools called Summit Public Schools that I think are really interesting.
Yeah. Featured in the Lean Startup, if I remember correctly, or at least one of the follow-ups. I think I learned about them through Lean Startup. Yeah. And then now Facebook's doing a bunch of work with them.
Yep. Mm-hmm. Facebook's devoted some engineers to help them build the software.
Pretty cool.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. It's nice when you're down the street from Facebook and they can say,
that's nice.
Summit is a great example of applying the Lean Startup philosophy to schools. So they started out as a high-performing charter school, you know, taking students who were not being well-served, a lot of lower-income, underrepresented students through their school system and preparing them to succeed in college. So, you know, in high school, teachers devoting a lot of time and attention working one-on-one with students to make sure everyone was college ready. And so that was great. But then they built and then they were measuring that outcome. And yes, their students were getting to college, but their students weren't succeeding in college at the level they hoped for their students. And so they measured that and they took those learnings back and put them into the schools and started this whole experiment with personalization of learning. They believed that part of the problem was that teachers were working so hard to intervene with students that students didn't have to manage their own learning process. So when they would get to college and there wasn't a lot of intervention, somebody's, you know, kind of cheering them on.
Right.
The support system, when that was removed, was a real problem for these students. So while they were academically prepared, maybe they weren't prepared to kind of manage their learning process. So Summit decided to experiment by removing those support systems from high school and focusing on building executive function and self-management, self-directed learning skills. And that took the form of a kind of very personalized learning path where students had a playlist of things they could learn on a computer and they would kind of move through that playlist with the help of a coach and a mentor.
Right.
But students had to move themselves forward, had to self-assess when they were ready to be assessed, you know, say like, okay, I'm ready to be tested.
I'll take the test now.
I'll prove my competency by doing a project versus just kind of being following out of school. And so, it's an experiment.
And has it worked? I mean, that's drastic, right? To go from, I'm going to do everything to you and get you graduated and get you into college. So that maybe your initial metric was percent entry into college. And now I know they're looking at graduated in 6 years or something, right? So it's that's pretty different. Is it working? I mean, do they see progress?
Kelly,
do you know?
Kelly, I feel terrible. I've told this story and I don't know how it ends.
We're going to look this up. We will give an update to the people.
You'll have to get somebody from Summit on your podcast.
Yes, that will be my next one.
You know, the last that stuck in my head is from a few years ago when they were still early. And I guess it's thoughtful experimenting, being aware, you know, they're measuring constantly. So we have students who this new system was clearly working well for, who were thriving and going beyond.
Yeah.
And were on track. And other students who were failing to self-manage. But measuring that constantly along the way means you can intervene with those students and get them on track.
Yeah.
While still experimenting.
It's a different set of skills to measure, right? Because now we're looking at... do you have the wherewithal to recognize, like, I don't know this, I need to go learn this, I need to now have the discipline to like learn it on my own? I mean, those are the things that you want in an employee even. I mean, go forget about college in 6 years. Like, this is what I want to hire as somebody running a company, is I want people that will take these ambiguous problems, learn whatever information they need to kind of solve them, and then solve the problem and move on, right? So it's pretty exciting.
It's somewhat structured, as far as I understand. You know, students have, you know, these are the things we hope you'll learn
in
this year, whatever this year may be, sixth grade or something. And here's the path you might take to go through them. And once you've learned these, we would suggest you go here next, but you kind of move at your own pace. You don't have to stop learning factoring of algebraic equations if you haven't figured it out yet. You know, if it doesn't make sense to you yet, why would you move on?
Keep on learning. Yeah.
So we talk about, you know, personalized competency-based learning, which I know you're well-versed in.
I think if people really stop and think about personalized competency-based learning, it's the question is not like, should it happen? I mean, it's hard. I haven't heard anybody really argue against like that this would be a good thing. I've heard a lot of arguments about, well, how do we actually do that? And how do we pull that off? And I think that's fair, but that's where it's getting back to way back at the beginning of this conversation where you're saying technology and sort of even the Silicon Valley way, even where it goes outside of technology, is really about finding something that works and helping scale it, right? Bring that to lots and lots of people. So I think not to start a fight, there's probably going to be like people commenting on this like, oh yeah, there's lots of arguments against competency, but it just makes so much sense that you wouldn't move on to level two material until you've understood level one, especially when there's a hierarchy of, you know, concepts.
Yeah, agreed. And I do read various, to me, inflammatory blog posts and things like that saying, I will never try personalized learning system.
I read that one.
But recently, yeah. But I think, you know, we can't give up on this idea because of some failed implementations.
Yeah.
So like I'm saying, it's not that personalization of learning or competency-based learning is not a good step forward. It's that we can implement that.
Yeah.
And we need to find the right way. And yeah. And I think this applies to technology as well. You know, if we're bringing technology into the education for the sake of having technology, all that is expensive, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Whereas if we have goals for what we want classrooms to look like, what we want education to be like for students, then we may find technology exists to support that. Like if we want to have a classroom where students spend some time learning on their own so that, or what I should be saying, if we want to have a classroom where there's lots of time for teachers to interact one-on-one or in small groups with students to help their learning move forward, then how can technology support that? How can technology support my child having more one-on-one time with the teacher?
Right. Yeah.
And getting more excited about science and math and English and history. And
thinking it's cool because I get to watch Mystery Doug at Mystery Doug talking about, you know, the rainfall. We did one of his activities recently. It was like, we built this giant plot of water on the earth. You know, we basically like took these sticky notes and made a bar chart on my wall and it went all the way up to the ceiling. We were talking about the salt water of the earth. It went all the way up the ceiling and around like across half the ceiling because it was such a huge bar, you know, the kids were just laughing hysterically and taking photos with it. I mean, have you ever seen people that excited about science? It was so cool. And as somebody that personally likes science, I was thrilled to see how that that lesson really engaged them and got them excited. We've done other ones since, and it's always the same. So
that's
good,
awesome.
Good stuff happening.
As a scientist.
Well, one thing I'll just, as we start to kind of wrap this up and be thinking about kind of your closing remarks here, Karen, but one thing I think is interesting as I listen to you talk about these things is, like you just alluded to, right? It's not about, I've got this technology, like where can I push it or where can I sell it or where can it fit in? Like a hammer I'm going to just start beating things with, right? It's it's really driven by, at least the examples that you've given, this is a need. This is something that I've experienced myself, or I've talked to lots of people and they've experienced it, or hopefully both, right? And then I've noticed, okay, this is just messed up. Like the way this is happening right now, the 5 a.m., you know, substitute teacher calls or whatever. And, I also happen to know that computers are capable of doing this in a much more elegant, easy way for everyone involved. And the computer is almost a side note in that story, isn't it? Because it's like, here's a problem. Here's a solution. Yes, we're using computers and the internet and other technologies to, you know, help make that solution real. But, you know, I think about that with what I'm doing too, is I want to do a new way of, I want the classroom to look fundamentally different. I want to build personalized learning and all these things in at scale. And it's like, yeah, I need a computer to make that possible, but it's not because I have a computer that I'm doing that model. Does that make sense? It's like, it's one supporting the other. And it seems like I'm hearing that as a thread in all of your examples.
Yeah. I can also give some, the scary side.
Yeah, let's do it. I think it'd be nice and honest of us to kind of talk about that.
So when you talk about shoving technology in, maybe without a goal or purpose, because right, you have a purpose of how you believe learning should progress for your students, how they should
experience
that, and technology turns out to be a good way to help make that happen. That's great. But let's look at like virtual reality or augmented reality software. We see lots of companies trying to figure out how we plug this into schools. And I believe in that. I mean, there's going to be a meaningful application of VR and AR in education.
Yeah, just read Ready Player One. It's right there.
Yeah, totally. Exactly.
Duh.
All right. So I told you this was the scary part, right?
No, I'm just kidding.
So we want some people thinking outside of, you know, normal boundaries of education to help move those ideas forward. Artificial intelligence. Right now I'm saying we don't want technology to replace teachers with robots, but hey, eventually artificial intelligence is going to be so good that it can't, you know, if it passes the Turing test, it interacts like a human and I can have an AI one-on-one tutor working with my student. Like maybe that's our future. I don't know.
Right. Well, people like Steve Wozniak or Elon Musk would definitely say, like, of course. Yeah, why not? I don't know. Elon Musk started his own school. Did you know this? For his kids and his employees' kids.
So there's
probably robots at that school. I have no idea what they're doing, but I would assume.
I don't know if Elon Musk has AI technology we don't know about, but if anybody does, probably him.
So. Well, but he wouldn't trust them either, so I don't know.
they have a safety release button. But, you know, so that may be where we're moving. And
yeah.
I would love for my child to have a one-on-one tutor, a human one, but maybe it's an AI that's good enough, you know? So
there's
this kind of future, but right now this is not what we're,
it's interesting.
Education. Eventually, you know, if we reach that AI future, many jobs are going to be displaced. We're going to have a new vision of the workforce and a brave new world, as they say. But right now,
and that's a Huxley reference. Like you weren't like just happening to use the title. You actually mean it in the most dystopian.
I don't know. I'm hoping it's a beautiful AI future.
It could be beautiful. Well, it's just interesting. People talk to me about this a lot when I explain to them, you know, what I'm doing. And it's like, my role feels very different than a teacher. Like my subject knowledge shows up at times, but always one-on-one, always kind of in these incidental conversations. Mostly what I'm doing with the kids is modeling a mindset and a passion for learning. I'm like doing the human side of, you know, coaching and motivating. Sometimes it's, you know, a more like fiery coaching where it's like, you know, come on, you can do better than this. And sometimes it's supportive. We had one of our students crying this week because he was looking at, you know, some Khan Academy tutorials and it was difficult and he didn't understand fractions. He was missing some of the underlying stuff. It wasn't that he's dumb or not capable. He hadn't been taught some of the basic stuff underneath it. So we had to go back and like say, okay, let's fill in these gaps, but that's emotional. And I have a hard time seeing computers anytime soon being able to really tease that out, right? And I know that there's people working on it, but you look at how fundamentally human learning can be and the psychological piece of it. So not to say I'm not worried about what you're talking about. I think it's all there, but it is interesting that there's such human stuff. And what I tell people is what I want to do is sort of rewrite that educator role to be actually more human than it is today, because you deal with all the, you know, any sort of like data collection, record keeping, like these types of tasks are built for computers. You know, computers are great for those and nobody's going to be sad to see them go. It's like, give me more time that I can one-on-one connect with these students and help them get excited about learning again. And that, anyway, sorry, I'm talking more than I'm supposed to talk. This is your show, Karen.
This is great. And I should say, I wouldn't say I'm worried about this AI future. I anticipate it with some.
Yeah. Segment. Could be great. Could be great.
It'll be amazing. Yeah. Or has the potential to be really amazing and good for.
Yeah. Pretty transformational.
But as you talk about your role as a teacher, that's really what, I mean, so you were experiencing this mystery science, this Doug, mystery Doug experiment with your students.
Totally.
And so they got to see your enthusiasm for science coming through as well. And that sounds amazing. And you had room for those human interactions, like you were saying. And I agree with the critics that we don't want a classroom where students spend all their time with their eyes on the screen.
Totally.
But how can we use some time with eyes on the screen to free up more time for debate and discussion in classroom, you know, to create more opportunity for community building and relationship development? I think technology can be a part of that picture. If that's what we set as our end goal as educators, we may find that there are technology tools to help us reach that end goal. And again, it's not about bringing in technology for its own sake. It's about what are our end goals for our students.
That's a great, I don't know if you meant that as a closing statement, but that sounds pretty definitive.
Yeah, I didn't walk into it that way, but it does feel like it's a good place to put my thoughts on this subject. There's anything else you'd like me to touch on?
Karen, this has been amazing. Thank you so much for just sharing about your experience, and you're doing just great work. I love that you're working with so many different companies, and I especially love, as you've talked about it, you know, that you're instilling in people this ethos of, you know, let's get out and really understand the problem. And then if the solution includes technology or whatever else it includes, you know, let's make learning better for kids. And I'm happy to hear that there's smart people like you that are out there, you know, addressing this. I feel like the future, you know, learners of the world, these kids that are growing up and going to school are going to be better for it.
Well, thank you. Thanks for the opportunity to talk about it. I should give credit. I try to, you know, take my own medicine and also spend a lot of my time talking with educators so that I don't get in this technology bubble and to really understand how they're perceiving technology, how they're as well. So a lot of credit to people who are kind enough to challenge me on what I think about all of this. And I know
awesome. Well, send them a copy of this podcast and I want the feedback too. So make sure I get it. I love this dialogue. And I think it's neat that there's more and more voices kind of being part of this bigger conversation around, you know, what education of the future is going to look like.
Yeah. Great. Thanks,
Thank you, Karen. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Prenda Podcast. I'd love to hear your thoughts about this conversation or innovating in education. And if you want to follow my progress designing a new model for school, you can learn more at school.prenda.co.